Hello and welcome to Columbia Evangelical Seminary's class, Writing Protocols, Punctuation, Grammar, and Academic Style. This is lecture number 5. My name is Rick Walston. This is the last lecture of the series. Today we'll be covering miscellaneous style points. Now, I need to tell you up front, this is going to be a very long lecture with a lot of technical data. So you may want to listen to this lecture in various parts. Listen to a little bit, turn it off, go back over it, and maybe just piecemeal it, or sit down and listen to the whole thing entirely. It's totally up to you. So in this lecture, I want to go through some miscellaneous style points, discussing things like footnotes, bibliography, page numbering, word usage, sentence length, and much more. The first thing I want to tell you is how to add the words emphasis added at the end of a quote. You can see example number 2 in Turabian. That'll help. But here we have the first line, he directed me to take the whole batch, emphasis added, period, footnote 7. This mechanical method needs to be understood. When you add emphasis to another person's words, you need to indicate that fact by placing the words emphasis added in parentheses at the end of a sentence. Now, look at the mechanical method in which it's laid out. It's parentheses, emphasis added, parentheses, period, and then the footnote. The period goes after the parenthetical note, and the footnote goes after the period with no intervening space. If you have added your emphasis in a scripture, a verse of scripture, it would look like this. Jesus wept, emphasis added, and then the passage of scripture, and then the period, and then the footnote. Turabian actually gives 3 different methods that one can use to indicate the added emphasis. However, CES has adopted the method shown above, which is reflected in Turabian's second method. So, if you use one of the other methods, it'll be considered incorrect. An appeal to one of the other methods given by Turabian will not help you, because the CES writing protocols follows only the second method that Turabian gives. And then stronger punctuation. Stronger punctuation takes the place of the comma. As I said earlier in an earlier lecture, when sentences containing 2 or more independent clauses are joined by a coordinating conjunction, and, but, or, nor, or for, a comma is always placed before the conjunction. However, in some constructions, when there is quoted matter with the punctuation, the stronger punctuation has priority over the comma. Here's an example. Well, we have 2 choices. One is, as Tom has pointed out, we can go left, but I think we'd be safer if we go to the right. Notice that after the second quoted sentence, we can go left, there is a coordinating conjunction, but, that joins another independent clause. Now, normally, we would place a comma before that coordinating conjunction, right? But in this sentence, since there is already an exclamation mark before the coordinating conjunction, there's no need for the comma. So here's an example of incorrect. You can see after we can go left, exclamation point, quotation, comma. Do not put the comma in after that. So allow the stronger punctuation to take the place of the comma in that construction. Next, book titles are to be either underlined or italicized. As for emphasis, underlining and italicizing are the same exact thing. Thus, you may either underline or italicize book titles, not both. You don't underline and italicize a book title. You do one or the other. Now, if you use italics for your first book that you reference, then you must continue to use italics thereafter throughout your paper. Sometimes students will write their paper and they will underline the book titles in the footnotes and italicize them in the body of the paper. Don't do that. Pick only one. I prefer to see italicized rather than underline, but you pick just one and you do it consistently throughout the entire paper. Now, chapter titles within books, however, are not underlined or italicized. Chapter titles within books are set off by quotation marks. Same with articles in magazines. Theses and dissertations also, the titles of theses and dissertations, are also placed inside quotation marks, not italicized nor underlined. Here's examples. Number 1. I think that chapter 7, quote, tight writing, unquote, in the book, Working with Words, is a fantastic chapter filled with important information. So you see the chapter title in chapter 7 is tight writing, and that's in quotes, but the book title itself is italicized. Next, the article, Searching for Life's Beginning. Now notice the title of the article is in quotes by Shirley Baron, MD, in Christianity Today. Now notice Christianity Today is italicized. So you have to make sure you put the title of the article in quotation, but the magazine name is italicized. And then finally, concerning theses and dissertations, Roger Johnson's thesis, The Sanctification Essence in Hebrews 4, note the title of a thesis or a dissertation is set off by quotes. It's not italicized nor underlined. All right. Word emphasis. Quotation marks are not for emphasis. A lot of people make this mistake, and I see this all the time where people will write and they're trying to emphasize a word, and to emphasize it, they put quote marks around it. But quote marks are not to be used for emphasis. In fact, quotation marks are used for one, to indicate that words are being quoted, or two, that they are used to indicate that a word is being used ironically or even with the opposite meaning. For example, this would be wrong. I really like, quote unquote, that painting. In this sentence, the writer thinks that he is emphasizing the word like, but actually he's doing just the opposite. Quotation marks are used for several purposes: to show direct quote, to indicate a chapter title within a book, to indicate a euphemism, or to indicate something is not true. It's almost like a wink of the eye. When I say to my wife, I really love our 15-year-old broken-down lawnmower, and then I smile and wink, what do I really mean? I hate that old lawnmower. That's what I really mean. Since the word like in our sample sentence above is not a direct quote, a chapter title, or a euphemism, the reader might think that it's supposed to mean just the opposite, sort of a wink of the eye. So instead of thinking of the reader, the word like might actually mean hate. To emphasize a word, then, you don't put it in quotation marks, you italicize it or underline it. Here's an example of the right way to do it. I really like that painting. Now you're emphasizing the word like. Again, you want to emphasize words by italicizing them. However, your writing should not be strewn throughout with italicized words. Use emphasis sparingly. One time a student's paper was so full of italicized words, I remember, that his total emphasis was lost. It's sort of like preachers. If a preacher raises his voice for emphasis for certain words or phrases, that's fine. You understand that there's a special emphasis on those words. However, if the preacher is just loud all the time and yelling all the time, then you never know what he's trying to emphasize, because the whole thing is just overwhelming. What quotation marks do mean? Quotation marks are to be used to indicate that words are either being quoted or to indicate that words are being used ironically. It often makes a word or phrase mean just the opposite. Example, my brother's wife is a, quote, real beauty, unquote, which means she's ugly. That's what it means. Someone sent this to me on an email. He said this was seen on a tavern door. It said, no one under age, quote, 21, unquote, permitted. Well, what does that mean? Well, no one under age 21, and the quote is there. It's kind of the wink of the eye. Now, they meant to emphasize it, but it's not emphasizing it. In fact, what was funny is somebody wrote underneath that, whoopee, beer for everybody. So it means sometimes just the opposite. So, again, you do not use quotation marks to emphasize words because it gives the wrong emphasis. To properly emphasize a word, you either underline it or place it in italics. But you don't, by the way, you don't do that. You don't do both. I've seen people underline and italicize words, the same word. You pick one or the other. It's either underlining or italics. Next, do not use one-sentence paragraphs in academic writing. In non-academic writing, a paragraph may contain only one sentence. However, generally a paragraph consists of two or more sentences, two to ten or more sentences, and can range anywhere from 32 to 250 words. For a paragraph to truly be a paragraph, it must develop a thought and be coherent. In other words, there should be a skillful development of a main thought. All the sentences in a paragraph should be geared to the expression of that thought in a clear fashion. Now, since a paragraph is the development of a thought, it's difficult to do an adequate job with just one sentence. I've read many term papers in which students had one-sentence paragraphs. I always told them they couldn't do that. But what was interesting is they generally misuse the one-sentence paragraph. What they typically use it for is the conclusion of the preceding paragraph. Somehow they have the idea that if they separate that final sentence from the preceding paragraph, it will have stronger punch to it. In fact, just the opposite happens. The preceding paragraph is left without an adequate conclusion, and the new one-sentence paragraph does not fulfill the requirements of being an actual paragraph. Therefore, You know, it's just better never to attempt to do a one-sentence paragraph at all in any of your writing. Now, less is more. This concerns sentence length. Concerning sentence length, you should use variation in your writing. Now, that sentence was 8 words. A sentence can be as short as 2 words, for example, Jesus wept, or as long as 40 words or more. That sentence was 19 words. If a paper is written with all very short sentences or all very long sentences, the writing style will be boring and mundane. You should vary your sentence length. However, it's good to remember that 16 words is considered a long sentence. You really need to highlight that line right there. 16 words is considered a long sentence. Sentences much longer than 16 words are sometimes difficult to follow. In fact, much of your point may be lost in the maze of extremely long sentences. Shorter sentences are generally better. They carry punch. Longer sentences have a tendency to lose their steam and their punch and their coherency about halfway through the point that you are trying to express to your reader. And then the reader has to keep going back to the earlier part of the sentence and reread it over a few times just so that he or she may be able to understand the context of what it was that you were trying to say in that long sentence, so that he or she will be able to fully understand the whole point of your long and of your convoluted sentence. And then, if he or she is lucky and bright and a good reader, and he or she doesn't mind working hard at understanding what it is that you are trying to express in that very long and drawn-out sentence while he or she is rereading the first part of your extremely long sentence, he or she won't forget the last part of your long and now quite boring sentence. That is, if you have written it in such a way that all of your grammar and all of your punctuation is correct. That was a 195-word sentence. Now, this is an extreme example of what not to do, but believe it or not, I've actually had student papers handed in with sentences this long. The last sentence, as I said, is just an extreme one. It's really long, and the fact is, as I said, 16 words is considered to be a long sentence. So it's my opinion that you should vary your length in writing, which means anywhere from 2 words to no more than 30 words, with the majority of your sentences being under 20 words. In brief, if you can keep your average sentence between 15 and 20 words, you'll be fine. But remember to make some sentences shorter than average and others longer than average. Now, one other note on sentence length, which you might find a bit interesting. Sentences in English writing have gotten shorter over the years. From about the time of the King James, when the King James Bible was first produced in 1611, up till 1900, sentences in English prose dropped in length by nearly 60%. That's a big reduction. From 1900 then to the present day, sentence length in English prose has reduced even more. So if you're in the habit of reading very old theological books or history books, you might be inclined to mimic their style and write longer sentences. Resist that inclination. One of our students tried to defend his excessively long sentences by saying that long sentences were more academic, while shorter sentences were non-academic. In reality, his long sentences were anything but academic. They were convoluted, vague, and improperly punctuated. In brief, his writing was atrocious. He produced some sentences that were simply impossible to understand. In fact, on one particular sentence, I asked him to interpret it for me because I couldn't interpret it, and a couple professors I asked to read it couldn't interpret it. The student stammered for a bit as he looked at his own sentence and then finally gave an interpretation that seemed to have nothing whatsoever to do with what he had written. Next, who failed? You did. If your reader cannot understand what you've written, then you failed. The whole point of writing something is to communicate information to others. If your readers do not understand the information, then you have not accomplished your task. Concerning this issue, William Zinsser says, "It won't do to say that the reader is too dumb or too lazy to keep pace with the train of thought. If the reader is lost, it's usually because the writer has not been careful enough." And that's true. Too often when I tell students, "I don't understand what you're attempting to say in this sentence or in this paragraph," they respond by saying, "Well, I know what I mean by it." Well, the problem with this, of course, is that the whole point of writing something is to communicate information to others, not to yourself. Presumably, you already know the information. Your job in writing is to make it understandable to your readers. One of my students actually tried to defend his poor writing style by saying that we should not make the reader the gauge of whether or not we have accomplished our goal as writers. And I just couldn't believe what he just said. So I responded to him by saying, "Then why write at all? I mean, if we're not communicating information through the medium of writing, why write? What other purpose for writing could there possibly be?" The ultimate inanity of his argument was that I, his professor, was the reader. So in essence, he was saying that it didn't matter if I could understand what he had written or not. But if I couldn't understand him, if I couldn't understand what he had written, what do you suppose I was going to give him for a grade? Next, choose the simple over the complex. Too often, students think that if they can toss in a few big or unfamiliar words into their writings, then their paper will be better. So they drag out their thesaurus and they look up big words and toss them in. Listen, just the opposite is true. In the course of writing and discussing writing, I've heard this phrase many times, write to express, not to impress. Big and unfamiliar words do not impress your professor. In fact, instead of being impressed, I'm often amused by students who attempt to use bigger, complex words and end up using them wrong. Also, big and unfamiliar words may serve to confuse the average reader rather than enlighten them. There are at least two ways to say something. Number one, the obtuse and convoluted way, and number two, the clear and easy way. Let me give you an example of number one, the obtuse and convoluted way. An ornithological specimen in digital captivity is of greater value than double-said specimen in dense foliage. Way two, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Now, not only does the second sentence use six fewer words, but the author has also chosen simple words over complex ones. There should be no doubt that way two is the better way to express this thought. Here's another example of what not to do. Branches from heavy foliage and jagged geological specimens may fracture my skeletal structure. However, inaccurate syntactical descriptions of my personage, heritage, or personality will never damage my psyche. Now, what do you think that is? It is sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Again, way two is the better way to express this thought. Here's another example that I thought was interesting. It came from a 1974 Fiat 124 Spider owner's manual. It said, ideogram illumination intensity adjustment potentiometer. Well, what does that mean? It means dimmer switch. See, technical words, be they in theology, philosophy, apologetics, ministry, or whatever, must occasionally be used. So I'm not advocating that all words be simple. What I am advocating, however, is that non-technical words in your paper should be just that, non-technical. Next, how to list Bible references. I'm amazed a bit at how often students don't seem to get this one correct. The traditional method of showing several verses when those verses are consecutive would look like this, John 3:16-21, and not as John 3:16, 21. John 3:16, 21 means that the reference is only to two verses, John 3:16-21. So you need to learn this. John 3:16 means John 3:16. John 3:16-21 means John 3:16-21. However, John 3:16, 21 means John 3:16-21. Also, when showing reference to more than one chapter and its verses within the same book, you would have a semicolon between the chapter and numbers. For instance, John 3:16, 21, 4:3-7, 5:1-2, 8. You see how that works? All right. Next, when to use Greek or Hebrew in academic papers? It seems to be a general rule of thumb that students who do not know Greek or Hebrew like to toss Greek and Hebrew words into their paper. The idea, apparently, is that they think that it makes their work look more scholarly. However, anyone with a parallel Greek and English Bible or Vine's complete expository dictionary of Old and New Testament words can look up a word and toss it into his paper. This is no great feat. Look at the following paragraph there. This is actually a paragraph that came from a student paper with all the added Greek words. Now, here's the point. Writing is for the purpose of communicating information. What possible benefit does the reader receive from seeing the transliterated Greek words in this paragraph? None whatsoever. These words are simply tossed into the paper showing the Greek letter equivalents, and they serve no useful benefit. The only time that you should use Greek or Hebrew words in your term papers is when the word in Greek or in Hebrew actually gives a fuller meaning that is not obvious in English, and when that is your point that you're trying to communicate to the reader, what is behind the Greek or the Hebrew. Don't just throw those words in for no good reason. Obviously now, for those who are doing actual Greek or Hebrew exegesis, or for those students doing study specifically in the languages, this limitation does not apply. But for those students who are not specifically doing term papers on a topic about the Greek or Hebrew language, they should not use Greek and Hebrew words in the papers unless there is a significant point not expressed in English that they are attempting to bring forth from the Greek or the Hebrew. For example, do not write, John says that Jesus is the word, Greek logos, of God, unless there is a specific nuance or connotation that you're going to develop from the Greek word logos. that's not readily apparent in English. Therefore, if you are not specifically going to develop a point about Greek or the Hebrew, the Greek or the Hebrew word, don't put it in your paper. It just ends up being dead wood. Next, read, edit, reread, re-edit, and re-edit your papers before you turn them in. All writers have what is called dead wood in their writing, at least in the early drafts. Dead wood in writing is unnecessary and superfluous words and phrases. Now let's take the dead wood out of that last sentence. Dead wood is unnecessary words. That's much better. Dead wood is also called verbosity or wordiness. As an example, how would you get the dead wood out of this next sentence? Remove each and every word for which you do not have any use. How about this? Remove useless words. See how much better that is? Here's another one. This is cop talk. The vehicle was traveling at a high rate of speed. How about this? The car was going fast. Much better. Change this one. The books that I am interested in are the theology texts. How about this? I'm interested in theology books. Sometimes getting rid of dead wood is simply converting lengthy phrases to shorter ones. Here's some examples. At this point in time, change it to now. All of a sudden, to suddenly. In the not too distant future, to soon. Every now and then, to occasionally. Also, adverbs are sometimes dead wood. For example, what is the difference in meaning between these two phrases, or these two sentences? He effectively changed directions and began heading in the opposite direction, or he changed directions and headed in the opposite direction. See, the adverb effectively is simply unnecessary here. It adds nothing to the sentence except dead wood. And what's the difference here? It is really true, and it is true. The adverb really is often superfluous. You can typically go through a student's paper and find all the reallys and get rid of them. Most often, 90%, maybe 95% of the word times that the word really is used is unnecessary. See, something can't be more true than true. So the adverb very is another one that's often superfluous. A student wrote in a term paper that Jesus Christ is very unique. Well, a thing or a person is either unique or it's not unique. Therefore, it is incorrect to say that something is very unique or more unique than something else. Next, never separate the subject of the sentence from its verb with a comma. Now, this happens all the time in student writing. This is a parenthetical departure, but at this point, I need to make another important comment. Too often, inexperienced writers separate the subject of the sentence from its verb with a comma. Here are a couple of examples. Both the subject and the verb are underlined in each example. The gigantic dog's huge paws, comma, walk slowly through the mud. Now, what's the subject? It's paws. What's the verb? It's walked. And notice there's a comma separating the subject from its verb. Don't do that. The next one. The mailman's bag, comma, was completely full. Again, do not separate the subject from its verb with a comma. And then the last one, the snowman's nose began to melt. In these three examples, the commas should be removed. Memorize this phrase. Never separate the subject from its verb with a comma. Next, do not use abbreviations in the text. That is, in the body of your work. You don't use abbreviations in the text of your academic papers. You may do so only in footnotes and appendices. For example, you should write out such words as New Testament and Old Testament. Don't use NT and OT. Also, in the text of academic papers, church denominations should be spelled out. For example, it should be the Assemblies of God, not AG. It should be the Evangelical Free Church, not EFC, and so on. Bible books should also be spelled out in the text. Thus, it is Genesis, not GN, period. It is Matthew, not MATT, period, and so on. However, when a word is cumbersomely long and has become well known by its abbreviated form, you may use the abbreviation. Now notice this, the DNA, the word there, the long word, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. You can use the letters DNA because that has become the new word for it. However, even when you do use abbreviations of this sort, the first time you use the word, you should spell it out and then indicate that you shall be using the abbreviated form thereafter. Here's an example of how to do that with the DNA in parentheses after the long word. Then you'll know what you're doing is you're telling the reader, this is the word, this is the abbreviation, and from this point on, this is what I'm going to use, DNA. All right, next. Do not use cliches. Cliches are old, tired, worn-out phrases that reveal your lack of creativity. In academic writing, the writing style should be direct prose and not symbolic or cliché. One apologetic student once wrote that, quote, Christianity takes a backseat to no other religion, unquote. So in the margin, I wrote, well then, does Christianity take a front seat to other religions? Another student wrote that Christianity, quote, Christianity has everything a person needs, the whole enchilada, if you will, unquote. So in the margin, I wrote, Christianity offers people a Mexican lunch? You see, words paint pictures. And since academic writing should not be symbolic, but straight prose, literal writing, think of the words literally and see if they make sense. If you have to interpret the word or phrase to mean something other than their literal meanings, then in all likelihood, you should not be using that word or phrase. People often don't even know what a cliché is. A cliché is an analogy that has been overused to the point that it indicates that the user of that cliché is a lazy thinker. Here are just a few clichés to help you see what they are. Some websites have listed thousands of them, so if you want to get on the internet, you can just type in, do a Google search of clichés, and you'll get lists and lists of clichés. But here's some. A kick in the seat of the pants. Eat your hat. Can't get a fair shake. A Copernican revolution. A labor of love. The road less traveled. Winners never quit, and quitters never win. In the doghouse. At the drop of a hat. As big as a whale. Well, I'm not going to read the rest of them. You can read them on your own. But you'll see these are clichés, and you should not use clichés in academic writing. Next, do not use academic titles in academic writing. So you don't use academic titles in your papers. When you're quoting from someone's work and that person is a doctor, do not use his academic title in your paper. So instead of saying something like, Dr. Robert Long argues convincingly for the doctrine of the Trinity in his book, Trinity Issues, rather, you would simply write, Robert Long argues convincingly. You just give the person's name. After the first time you give the person's name, first and last name, like Robert Long, then after that you can just use his last name and just simply say Long. Now, if you're using Robert Long's work throughout your dissertation or your paper, and you're going to be referring to him from, you know, early pages to the latter pages, every once in a while you'll want to throw back in his first name just to keep the reader aware that this is Robert Long. Next, confused abbreviations. Inexperienced writers often confuse abbreviations, and you need to learn these. Etc. At ETC period, etc. means other unspecified things of the same class, or, and so forth. It is not a sort of catch-all. For example, this would be incorrect. Bring sandwiches, a toothbrush, gloves, etc. Why does etc. not work here? Because these are not items of the same class. What does a toothbrush have in common with gloves? So as the reader, I don't have to already know everything in your etc., but I should have a strong clue as to what the etc. includes because of the class or type of items that you've listed. Here's another example of the wrong way. Dad was upset at the plumber and Mom was late to work, etc. Here's an example of the right way. Galatians chapter 5 says that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, etc. Here, the class is identified. It is the fruit of the Spirit. So don't use etc. as sort of a catch-all. E.g. means, for example, and is often confused with I.E. I.E. means that is. Also, a comma follows these last two abbreviations. One thing that should be kept in mind as you write, in these sorts of abbreviations should not appear in the regular text of your paper, but should be confined to parenthetical references in the text, i.e. in the body of the paper, just like it was in the last sentence. Ibid. Means in the same place. And then CF means compare and should not be used to mean see. Like IBID, this abbreviation CF should not appear in the regular text, but it should be confined to notes and other scholarly apparatus. C means to refer to or to read. FF means and following. Example, John 3:16 FF means John chapter 3, verse 16 and following verses. And now sick in brackets. Sick means thus, and it should be italicized or underlined and placed in brackets. Sick is to be used when you are quoting someone who has made a mistake in grammar or spelling or whatever, and you wish to make it clear to your reader that you are quoting the person correctly and that it was he who made the mistake and not you. However, the sick should not be overused. For example, in some very old works, people spelled words differently than we do today. So when quoting from something archaic, do not litter your quote. with sick. Next, block quotations. When you have four lines or more of material to quote, you should place the material into a block quote. Okay? You need to memorize that. When do I do a block quote? When you have four or more lines of text. Thus, no block quote should be shorter than four full lines of text. The block quote should be single-spaced, and do not put beginning and ending quotation marks around a block quote. Below, actually on the following page, I have given a sample that will give you that will show you several important things, including the proper block quote. Here are several things that you should pay special attention to. Number one, notice how the writer refers to himself in third person as this researcher. That's how you are to refer to yourself in academic writing, or as this student. Remember, refer to yourself only when it is absolutely necessary. In fact, it's best if you spend time rewriting the sentence in such a way that you do not have to refer to yourself at all. Number two, note that the text material is double-spaced except for the block quote, which is single-spaced. Number three, in the sample below are two types of quotes, a block quote and an in-text quote. The in-text quote does have the necessary quotation marks around it. Number four, the block quote does not have a beginning and ending quotation marks around it. Number five, when you have a quote within a text quote, you set off the quote inside the quote in single quotation marks. However, a quote within a block quote takes the regular double quotation marks. Now we'll be looking at these as we go. Then number six, both of these quotes, the in-text quote and the block quote, have their proper footnotes, and you need to learn how footnotes are done. And then number seven, all writing in academic papers must have the ragged right edge as the sample shows. So, let's take a look at this first line. It says, this first paragraph, it says, in the opinion of this researcher, notice that, not in my opinion. Again, you don't speak in first person, you speak in third person. So, this researcher and the position of this dissertation. It is the opinion of this researcher and the position of this dissertation that much of the truth about psychological types is harmonious with the motivational gifts theory. Just as there are various psychological personality types, so there are different gifts which in essence make up the different personality types. Gary Harbaugh, notice I don't say Dr. Gary Harbaugh, it's just Gary Harbaugh says that in discussing, and now we've got a quote, you've got Gary Harbaugh says that, comma, quote, in discussing gifts, it is indeed possible to integrate psychological insight. Now notice it's a single quote now. So in Gary's book, he had psychological insight in quotes, but now that I'm quoting a larger portion of his work, I have to put that quote in single quotes. So first of all, you start with double quotes, and there's a quote inside the quote, you have single quotes. Psychological insight with theological understanding, period, then the quotation mark, and then the number. And notice, the period goes first, quotation mark, and then the footnote, and there are no intervening spaces between the period, the quotation mark, nor the footnote. All right? And then it goes on to say, further, Harbaugh sees human personalities as gifts from God. He states, now, notice when I put here, I put a colon here, because I'm giving an attribution to several of his, it's going to be four or more lines, setting up a block quote. So you start it with the colon. Now, I won't take the time to go through all of this, but if you'll notice, third line down, second word from the right, it says personhood. Now, in his quote, this quote was quoted, so we put the quote in this because we do not have beginning or ending quotes in the block quote. And then notice at the end, there's just the period and then the footnote. And again, there's no intervening space between the period and the footnote number. And the footnote comes, and the period goes first. At the end of the in-text quote, note the punctuation. It said, with theological understanding. We talked about that a moment ago. Period, quotation mark, number. Learn the order. First comes the period, then comes the quotation marks, then comes the footnote number. Note also that there are no spaces between these items. So here's some things that you should learn from the footnote. Number one, the footnote is indented to the same space as the regular paragraphs in the body of the work. Here's the indentations and how it should look. If you're in a body of a, if you're in the body of the paragraph or body of the paper, paragraphs go in seven spaces from the left-hand margin, block quotes four spaces, and then footnotes, seven spaces. Now, let's actually take a look at the footnote below. It says, number two, Gary L. Harbaugh, comma, God's Gifted People. Now, in this particular footnote, I have underlined the book title. You can underline it, or you can italicize it, one or the other. Then it's got parentheses, Minneapolis, comma, Minnesota. It's MN, colon, and then the publishing company, the date, comma, parentheses, comma, and then page. You need the P for page 20. Now notice the IBID below. What does that mean? That means that the next quote comes, quote two is from Gary Harbaugh's book, so is quote three, and it just means in the same place, page 17. Now, if it were exactly the same page, it would just say IBID. But since it's the same book but a different page, you have to indicate the page as well. Now, on page, the next page, note number two, the author's name is given in its natural order in the footnote. Name first, first name first, etc. Number three, the book title is underlined or italicized. Number four, the city and state are given, then colon, publisher, and then the year of the copyright. All of this is in parentheses. Number five, the page number is given. Number six, the block quote is from the same text but located on a different page number. Thus, it is IBID, and as I just talked about it a moment ago, IBID means in the same place. And it's used in footnotes to refer to the book, chapter, article, or page just cited just before. Though the spacing for the footnote is single-spaced and not double-spaced like the text, the space between the footnote entries is double-spaced. You'll need to remember number seven. Footnoting should be single-spaced, but entries between footnotes is double-spaced. Now, how do you indent when you're writing your paragraphs in your regular paper? Some students just put spaces between their paragraphs. You don't do that. You indent to show paragraphs. Your indentation for your paragraph should be seven spaces. You look here, it says example, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then the begins right there at seven. Dropping down to the next paragraph, you can see the paragraph begins at the same exact spot, but the block quote goes in only four. See the block quote below? And then footnotes, the first line of the footnote is indented the same number of spaces as the paragraphs in the body of the work. And the other lines come back to the margin, just like the regular text. One way to help you remember the indentation guidelines is just remember 747, like an airplane, 747. Just think of 747, seven spaces for paragraphs, four spaces for block quotes, seven spaces for footnotes. Now the dreaded comma. It is very interesting that people with some college background often become upset or offended when it's pointed out that their commas are incorrect in their writing. Some people seem to have the idea that commas are personal issues of punctuation, and what's right for one person may not be right for another. In fact, one of my students argued with me concerning the correction that I had made on his paper concerning his comma use by saying, well, that's your style, I have a different style. But you see, commas are rarely a matter of style. The placement of commas is far more a science than it is an art, and like 2 plus 2 equals 4, so in many situations the use of commas in proper punctuation is an absolute. I deal with commas in Lecture 1 under General Rules of Punctuation, so if you aren't sure about where commas go, please go back to Lecture 1 and reread those notes and maybe listen to the lecture again. Comma with date, month, and year. This is one of those situations where Turabian gives a couple different options. However, CES Writing Protocols calls for the second option that Turabian gives to be used for our papers. Option 2 puts the month first, day second, and then third, the year. For example, on June 3, 2015, the graduation ceremony will be in Pittsburgh. Next, what do you do with the abbreviations senior, junior, the third, the fourth, and so on, with the issue of commas? It's an interesting but virtually unknown fact that the abbreviation of junior or senior should not have a comma before it. Here's an example of the wrong way. Robert Hamilton, senior, or Robert Hamilton, junior. The example of the right way is no commas before senior or junior. You can imagine the response of someone who has junior or senior, who has had the senior or junior abbreviation in his name and has been adding the comma before the abbreviation for years, when he's told that he's been writing his own name incorrectly. The reason no comma is used in the name is because the terms senior and junior are restrictive clauses. Now, for an explanation of restrictive clauses, see Lecture 1. Now, you should have remembered that. In fact, that's something I told you should make flashcards about, restrictive and non-restrictive clauses and when to use the commas with them. Now, degree titles, however, are different than the junior and senior because degree titles are non-restrictive clauses, so then, therefore, you must have a comma before that. So you wouldn't put Robert Hamilton, no comma, MBA. You'd put Robert Hamilton, MBA, or Robert Hamilton, PhD. Notice also that there are no spaces between the letters of degree titles. Thus, it is PhD, not PH space D. Another thing that people often mess up are the initials of people's names. There must be spaces and periods between the initials of a person's name. Example of wrong, R.F. Hamilton. Example of right, R space F Hamilton. It's actually R period space F period space Hamilton. Just think of it this way. You would not run a person's first and middle names together like Robert Frank without a space. You would have Robert space Frank. Well, neither should you run a person's initials together because those are representing his name. So just as there are spaces between a person's name or names, so there should be spaces between a person's initials. Next, the ellipses. I will only make a couple of points about the ellipses. You should go to Turabian and read more about this to get a fuller explanation. Number one, there are spaces before, between, and after the periods or dots in an ellipses. Too often people simply place three dots close together like this as their ellipses. This is incorrect. An ellipses has spaces before, between, and after the dots. So it would be after the dots, space, period, space, period, space, like that. Number two, ellipses take the place of words that have been left out from the midst of a sentence. Example, ellipses take the place of words that have been left out, space, dot, space, dot, space, dot, space, of a sentence. See how that works? Number three, if the ellipses is indicating the removal of a whole sentence or whole sentences, the ellipses follows after the last sentence's terminal punctuation. Thus, you would have four dots in a row. Look at the example. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life, period, space, period, space, period, space, period, space. And then it picks up again with whoever believes. Now, the reference here is John 3:16, 18. Now note that there was a regular ending period after verse 16, a space, then three dots, which took the place of verse 17, and then a final space, and then the next sentence, verse 18. Note also that the text citation is John 3:16, 18, and not John 3:16, 18. The reason why is because verses 16-18 would include verse 17, but verse 17 was left out. So that's how you use ellipses. Now, how to do footnotes. CES and Turabian differ on some aspects of footnote style, so you're going to go by CES style. Now, this is something that you're just going to have to learn. You're going to have to get it down into your head because you're going to be writing footnotes on all of your papers and on most of your pages on every paper that you write. So the first thing you look at is the CES style. You'll notice there, you give the author, you give the book title in italics, then you put in parentheses the city and state, colon, publisher, comma, year, parentheses, comma, page, and then the number. The first sample footnote here is Rick Walston. Now notice the first thing, the number one, there's no space between the footnote number one and the R on Rick. There's no intervening space between the number and the first letter of the person's name. Second thing you should note is that it is indented. Remember, footnotes are indented in the same line as with the regular paragraph. Then it's Rick Walston, comma, the Speaking in Tongues controversy, that's the name of the book, in italics. Then there's no comma or period, but then it simply starts with a parentheses, then the city and state of the publisher, colon, not a period, but a colon, Xeron Press, comma, and then the year of publication, then the closing parentheses, the comma, P for page, period, and then the page number. Look at the very next one. Again, it's indented. You need to know that. The number is not separated. There's no intervening space between the number and the first letter of the person's name. There's a comma after the person's name, then the book title in italics, and then the city and state and publisher and year in the parentheses, comma. Now notice this one is PP because it's multiple pages. So PP, period, and then the number of, and then the page numbers. So that's what you need to know about the footnotes. Now, there are 10 things to know about the footnote. First, the first line of the footnote is to be indented 7 spaces. Second, footnotes are to be single spaced. Third, the space between footnote entries, however, is to be double spaced. Just like you see above, you see the two footnote samples, they're single spaced with a double space between the entries. Fourth, There is no space between the footnote number and the first letter of the author's name. Fifth, the book title is italicized, or it can be underlined. Pick a style and be consistent. Sixth, both the city and the state of the publisher are listed. On occasion, the state is not clearly printed in the front matter of the book. This is especially true of books published outside the USA. When that's the case, when you do not know the state, when it's not listed in the front matter, you can just, first of all, you should attempt to find it. If you cannot find it, you may simply leave the state out of the footnote. Then you would just put, the city, like for instance, it might be, well, the one publisher is Grand Rapids, Michigan, so that would be Grand Rapids, comma, MI, colon. If you couldn't find the state, you would just put Grand Rapids and then colon and then the rest of the information. Now, Turabian typically does not list the state in her format. However, there must have been some confusion for her because even in her book, she's not consistent. In her book, she typically doesn't list the state, but on occasion she does. And then when she does list the state, she's not consistent on how to abbreviate the states. So that's number seven for us. The state is abbreviated with CES, with the normal abbreviations of states following the U.S. Postal Office designation. That's two uppercase letters. Do not abbreviate states with several letters like Calif or Mass or Min or Wash. Here's a list of the states with the appropriate abbreviations. So when you find any of these states, look on this page to find out what the abbreviation is. Eighth, there's a colon after the two uppercase letters for the state. Ninth, the P is given to denote the word page. When the footnote is citing multiple pages, it must be PP, period. Tenth, the footnote must appear on the same page. Now, this is a very important one. Well, all of this information is very important, but this one I see quite often, students mess this up. The footnote must appear on the same page as the quotation to which it refers. Next, here are a few more sample footnotes. The first one is a simple footnote from a book. See Peter Wagner. Oh, there should be a comma after his name. Spiritual Gifts Can Help Your Church Grow is in italics. That's the title of his book. Ventura, comma, California, colon after California, Regal Books, comma, 1979, comma, page, period, 160, period. Once a full listing for a book has been given, like the one just previously read, it can be simply abbreviated thereafter. A sample abbreviation for C. Peter Wagner's book, Spiritual Gifts Can Help Your Church Grow, would look like this. Wagner, page 161. That's all that's necessary is the author's last name and the page number of the book. However, if you are going to be quoting from two or more different books by the same author, then you must make sure that the different texts are clearly listed in the abbreviation. For instance, if you were quoting from three different books by C. Peter Wagner, your abbreviations would include either or all or a portion of the book titles to indicate which of the Wagner texts you're quoting from. Here are some examples. First one is Wagner, Spiritual Gifts Can Help, page 160. Wagner, comma, Blazing the Way, comma, page 113. Wagner, Lighting the World. You see, so you would put a little bit of the title of the book, or in fact the entire title if you want, but you can abbreviate it if you like, just enough to make sure that the reader will know which book you're quoting from of C. Peter Wagner's. Next, if you are quoting from two authors with the same last name, you will need to add their first names in the abbreviated format to distinguish between them. Here are two authors with the same last name. The first mention of their books has the full data, as always. After that, they can be abbreviated, but so as to tell them apart, their first names have been included. Norman A. Geiser, Chosen But Free, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Bethany House Publishers, 1999, page 103. Then Norman Geiser, Chosen. You see, that's the abbreviation, but we're keeping his first name because the next author that we're quoting in our paper is Mark P. Geisler. So if we just say Geisler, it could be confusing. So Mark P. Geisler, Issues and Free Will, so on and so forth, and then when we abbreviate, we put Mark Geisler and the abbreviation of the title Issues. All right. When there are footnotes from footnotes from a book by two or more authors, you simply lay out the names as you see it here, Norman Geisler and Paul Feinberg. Then you do the footnote, the rest of the footnote, just the same way. And when it's three or more authors, you have the comma between the first two, Rick Gant, comma, Paul Jones, comma, and Larry Towers. Now you notice that we have commas in where we didn't have it in the first one, but we do have it in the second one. If the book has more than three authors, then you follow the same format as the last example. And then you'll see here a footnote sample from a dictionary, which is a little different. You've got the title of the dictionary, and then you have SV, which indicates the word that you're looking up. And then syndrome, in quotes, that's the word we looked up in the dictionary. Now, a footnote for a thesis or dissertation. Now, since theses and dissertations are not published books, they're placed in quotation marks and not italicized nor underlined. For instance, Randy Powers, and then in quotes, is the name of his dissertation, Semantic Studies of the Psalms of David. But notice now, it's in parentheses, you put PhD, Dis, and then the university where it's located, where he wrote his dissertation, the year, and then the page. The next thing is IBID. Now, we talked about that earlier, so we won't take a lot of time to go over it. Basically, IBID just simply means in the same place. So after you've quoted a book, if you're going to the very next quote, if it's from the same source, you just put IBID. If it's the same exact page number as the previous quote, then you just do IBID. If it's another page number, but the same book, then you put IBID, period, comma, and then the page number. All right, and you'll see some examples below. See Peter Wagner, so on and so forth, the information, and then 14, footnote 14 says IBID with a period. But when you have that page number, because it's the same book, but now it's on a different page, you would put IBID, period, comma, P, period, and then page number. All right. When citing the work of one author as found in the book of another author, both works must be mentioned in the footnote. For example, Bonnie Moore, Issues of Light and Dark, Lomax, Washington, so on and so forth, citing Paul B. Smith, Sincerity and Sin. You see how that works? So if you're not quoting a primary source, but you're quoting somebody within another person's book, and so Bonnie Moore has quoted Michael Smith, and you're quoting Bonnie Moore quoting Michael Smith, then you put both sets of information in there. Now, content footnotes, or also called substantive notes. Sometimes students want to write something and explain something that doesn't exactly fit into the text, so they think they should write it all out in a footnote. And I've seen sometimes where students have a quarter of their page at the base, an explanation of something that they've written above. However, in academic writing, most everything that is worthy of incorporation into the work should be in the main body of the text. If the information is so peripheral that it only rates a footnote, then leave it out, unless it helps the reader better understand the citation or why the information in the text was important enough to be cited. But in brief, think of it this way. If it's not important enough to be in the text, it probably should not be in the footnote either. If it is important enough to be in a footnote, then it should probably be incorporated into the body of the text. So in other words, stay away from content footnotes as much as possible and simply explain it in the text, and if it doesn't fit in the text, don't put it in at all. Interpolations. Interpolations are insertions or additions of your material or thoughts into a text. When you add an interpolation into a quote, you should show your addition by the use of brackets. So, for example, in John 3:16 with interpolations, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son," and then in brackets, "Jesus Christ, that whoever," in brackets, that includes you, "leaves in him should not perish," and so on and so forth, and you can see the interpolations for yourself. Now, some people confuse the use of brackets with the use of parentheses. Here is the key. Brackets are to be used when you are inserting your thoughts or clarifications into someone else's quote. Parentheses are to be used when you are inserting your thoughts or clarifications into your own writing. Okay, do you have that? Brackets are when you're inserting your thoughts or clarifications into somebody else's words. Parentheses are used when you're inserting your thoughts or your clarifications into your own words. Now, do not overdo interpolations. Neither the brackets nor the parentheses should be overdone. The ridiculous insertions demonstrated above in John 3:16 are interpolations run amok, okay? So simply do not put them in if you do not need them. Drop down and to the first example. It says, "In 1866, Xavier Sullivan said, 'The oft-quoted passage of John 3:16 still brings me peace.'" Now, drop down to the next example. It says, "In 1866, Xavier Sullivan said, 'The often quoted passage.'" Now you can see here that the person thought that he needed to give an interpolation here and put the EN there to help the reader understand that it's the often quoted passage, not just the oft quoted passage. But this is simply unnecessary and superfluous to put this in here, and here's why. The governing rule of whether or not to put an interpolation is this. If you had to research and learn what the word meant, and the reason why you're putting in the interpolation, if you had to research it and to learn what it meant, then use an interpolation. However, if you knew when you read it what it meant, then your reader probably will too. Do not put all these interpolations into your passage, into your work, unless it's absolutely necessary for clarification for the reader. But if the rule of thumb is, if you understood it without it, then your reader will understand it without it. All right, general formatting issues. Text pagination. This is page numbering. I'm constantly amused by how simple this is, and yet so many people can't seem to get it right. Here it is. Page numbers go at the top right corner of the page, 1 inch from the top, except on title pages, where they go at the bottom center, 1 inch from the bottom. Okay? All page numbers go top right, except on title pages. Now, what's a title page? In a thesis or dissertation, the title pages are the first page of each chapter. On a regular academic term paper, there's only one title page, and that's the first page number one. And then after that, all the pages are numbered at the top right. Front matter pagination. Now, this is dealing with dissertations and theses, because an academic term paper doesn't have a front matter. It has a simple cover page, but not front matter. Front matter is the printed material in front of a book or a thesis or dissertation before the actual text. This includes the title, the copyright pages, dedication, foreword, preface, table of contents, and all of that. Lowercase Roman numerals are to be used at the bottom center of each of those pages. For more information about how to number the front matter, see Turabian. Margins. How do you make the what size margins do you use in your papers? All academic papers, dissertations, and theses. Here it is. Top and bottom and right margins are to be one inch each. The left margin is to be 1.5 inches. Now, the reason for that is when the work is bound, you need an extra space on the left-hand side. That's why the left margin is to be 1.5 inches. I remember once that a dissertation I submitted came back to me with a red ink mark indicating that my top margin was 1/64 of an inch under the necessary 1 inch, and every page of my dissertation had to be changed and reformatted. Next, ragged right edge. In academic papers, do not justify the margin on the right side. Leave it ragged edge. Footnotes are also to be ragged right edge. And then double spacing. Your text in the body of your paper, whether it's a dissertation, a thesis, or just an academic paper, should be double-spaced. However, block quotes are to be single-spaced, and footnotes are to be single-spaced with double space between the entries. Spelling. Wow. It seems that something this basic shouldn't have to be mentioned in a class of this sort. You know that you're supposed to spell correctly, but you'd be surprised at how many students hand in papers with typos, simply apparently because they did not run it through their spell checker. If you have a spell checker, use it often, and use it before you ever print out your final paper. Next, the passive voice. When writing term papers, theses, and dissertations, do not use the passive voice. We've talked about this before, and I'm just going to skip over this right now. You can read it on your own, go back to earlier lectures, and learn what the passive voice is if you don't remember. Contractions, don't use them, okay? Contractions are words like don't for do not, or can't for cannot, and won't for will not. Contractions are appropriate only in informal writing, such as letters and memos and quoting of speech. So, do not use contractions in your paper. Next, exclamation mark. Now, the exclamation point is a little piece of punctuation that shows that you're excited or upset or some sort of emotional outburst. Do not use exclamation points in academic research papers. It's just that simple. Too many writers pepper their writings with exclamation points. In fact, exclamation points are not even appropriate in academic writing. Here's why. They show an emotional outburst. Now, what's the difference between these two sentences? The Bible is the most truthful book ever written, and the Bible is the most truthful book ever written. One is an exclamatory sentence, and one is a declaratory sentence. The first sentence is loaded with emotion and opinion, and the second sentence is a simple statement of fact. When you're dealing with academics, that's what you're dealing with, facts, not emotion. In writing academic papers, your job is to state and defend. You need to state your case and defend it. You might make the statement, the Bible is the most truthful book ever written, and then you would go on to defend or prove that statement. Here's another sample. Jesus is Lord, and Jesus is Lord. The first sentence belongs in your preaching, and the second one belongs in your academic paper. You see the exclamation mark, as I said, indicates excitement, and sometimes it indicates amazement. For example, I think there was a paper, there was a student's paper that came in, and it was on apologetics, and toward the end of the paper, this sentence was there. After all that undeniable evidence, the atheist still did not capitulate. Well, it's not our job as academic writers to express amazement. It's not your job to express your emotion or your amazement. When you do that, you're telling your reader how he or she is supposed to feel about something, and that's not your job. Your job is to convince them, not persuade them with emotion. So it's vitally important that students realize that their job in writing a research paper is simply to state and defend. You are to state your position, for example, Jesus is Lord, and then you are to give the evidence for your claim. Your job is simply to state and defend. I can't tell you the number of student papers that I've read in which students made all sorts of assertions without defending them. One student once asserted that, quote, most Christian scholars today are more concerned with the approval of men than the approval of God. Most? I thought to myself, wow, that's a big assertion. You see, he had given no proof for his assertion. He just made a statement. But you can't do that. You cannot make these kind of emotional, outburstive statements and expect them to remain in your paper. Every time you make an assertion, you must back it up with proof. This person had to remove that line from his paper. And I believe if you've done your job well in arguing your position without emotion and without unfounded assertions, then your reader will be excited about your conclusion. You do not have to exclaim that Jesus is Lord. If you've adequately given the evidence for your claim and you have done your job well, your reader will exclaim, Jesus is Lord. And that's the real goal of your paper, to convince your readers of your position, to persuade them with evidence, not emotion, that your position is the right one. I want you to go ahead and finish reading through the material there on this. But right now I'm going to jump forward in this to the 14 anathemas in academic writing. These are the 14 anathemas. This basically covers quickly what we've already covered in this lecture. Number one, commas and periods outside the quotation marks are an anathema. Oh, what is an anathema? Well, hopefully you've read it there, or hopefully you already know the word, but it means something greatly reviled, loathed, hated, shunned, okay? So what's bad? These are the 14 bad things in academic writing. Commas and periods outside the quotation marks, that's bad. Exclamation points or exclamation marks, that's bad. Sarcasm. Don't use sarcasm in academic writing because it has no place in academic writing. Again, state and defend facts, not sarcasm, not emotion. Number four, emotional outbursts, bad. Number five, wrong pagination or wrong page numbers. Number six, wrong margins, wrong size margins. Number seven, misspelled words. Number eight, extremely long sentences. Number nine, misuse of commas. 10, use of first and second person personal pronouns. Bad. Number 11, cliches. Do not use cliches. Number 12, improper style in footnotes. Number 13, assertions without a proper defense. And 14, writing in the passive voice. That's bad. So these are the 14 anathemas in academic writing. Well, we've come to our final section, and that is the exercise on Lecture 5. What you'll need to do now is simply stop the lecture, do the exercise on number 5, and then come back to this lecture after you've done it and check with me, and I will give you the answers, and then you can see how well you've done. Go ahead and turn off the lecture now. All right. Lecture 5, the exercise there. Just read and follow the instructions in each question. Number 1, true or false? When sentences contain two or more short independent clauses are joined by a coordinating conjunction, no comma is needed. False. Always needed. Number 2. Punctuate this sentence correctly. John arrived early, comma, and Mary came later. Number 3. Which of the following reflects the correct mechanical method of the addition of emphasis added, also known as emphasis mined, but it should be emphasis added in academic papers? It is A. And then which of these is correct? Again, it is A. Number 4, punctuate this sentence correctly. Well, we have two choices. One is, as Tom has pointed out, we can go left or we can go right. Leave it as is. It's completely fine as it is. If you did anything at all with it, You could have placed a comma after the word out. Number five, underline or italics can be used for two things. What are they? They're used for book titles and emphasis of words. Number six, true or false. You should avoid writing one-sentence paragraphs in academic papers. True. Number seven, how many words does it take to be considered a long sentence? 16. Eight, if your reader cannot understand what you have written, who failed? You did, or I did. You can put I did. Number nine, fill in the blank. Write to express, not to impress. Number 10, true or false. It is okay to use cliches in academic term papers. False. Number 11, what is dead wood in writing? It's unnecessary words or phrases. 12, you may use abbreviations in the text, i.e. the body of the paper. False. 13, you may use the abbreviation of doctor in academic term papers. False. 14, the abbreviation etc. is a sort of catch-all that you can use at the end of sentences. False. 15, e.g. means that is, while i.e. means for example. False. Number 16, the word sick, which means so thus, should be italicized and placed in brackets like this. Sick. True. 17, when you have four full lines of material to quote. Number 18, if a writer of an academic term paper must refer to himself, he must use the third person personal pronoun. 19, the main text material, that is the body of the paper, of a term paper is to be double spaced. A block quote is to be single spaced. 21, the block quote does not have beginning and ending quotation marks. True. 22. In the main text, when you have a quote within a quote, you set off the inside quote in single quotation marks. 23. When you have a quote within a block quote, you set off the inside quote in double quotation marks. 24. All writing in academic papers must have the ragged edge. Let's back up for a moment here to the 23 and 22 inside the quote marks. By the way, never put anything in single quotes except for quotes inside of quotes. Sometimes a person will just put the word theology, for instance, and put single quotes around it. Don't do that. If you're going to put quotes around anything, you always use double quotes unless it is a quote with inside a quote. Okay? 25. Fill in the punctuation and fix anything that may be wrong in this footnote. Well, the one in Gary is right, and it's indented correctly, but there should be a period after L, Gary L, period, Harbaugh, comma. Then after people and before Minneapolis, there should be the beginning parentheses, a comma after Minneapolis. The state abbreviation MIN should be changed to capital M, capital N with a colon after it. Then there should be a comma after house, then a parenthesis, closing parenthesis after 1988, and a comma after that, and then the rest of it is correct. Number 6, or 26, noting the mechanics at the end of the quote, which of these is correct? Number A is correct. 27, fill in the blanks concerning the indentations. It is 7-4-7. 28, book titles and magazine titles must be either underlined or italicized. True or false, ibid means in the same place and is used in footnotes to refer to the book, chapter, article, or page just cited. True. 30, footnotes are to be single spaced, but the space between the footnote entries is double spaced. 31, commas are unique punctuation marks in that they are to be used according to one's personal style and preference. Thus, commas are personal issues of punctuation, and what is right for one person may not be right for another person. False. Number 32. Which is the correct use of the commas with the title junior? It is B, because there's no comma with the title junior. 34. True or false? There are no spaces before, between, or after periods or dots in an ellipses. False. 35. Every time a block quote is taken from a book, The footnote must give the full citation of it. I'm sorry, I said block quote. Every time a quote is taken from a book, the footnote must give the full citation of the book's information. That's false. You can abbreviate after the first full entry. Number 36, concerning interpolations. Brackets are to be used when you are inserting your thoughts or clarifications into someone else's words. 37, the answer is your own words. 38, where do page numbers go in academic writing? They go on the top right corner, 1 inch from the top, except for title pages, where the number goes at the bottom center, 1 inch from the bottom. 39, top margin 1 inch, bottom margin 1 inch, right margin 1 inch, left margin 1.5 inches. Number 40, academic papers have the justified right margin. False. Number 41, I, me, my, mine, we, ours are called first person personal pronouns. 42, the passive voice is acceptable in academic writing. False. 43, you ain't supposed to use contractions in academic papers. True. 44, exclamation marks should be used often in academic writing because they indicate a punch that is simply not in normal writing. Blah, blah, blah. That's false. Number 45, sarcasm is a good tool. That's what I just used, wasn't it? Sarcasm is a good tool to use in academic papers because it discredits your opponent. False. Your job in writing your academic paper is to state and defend your position. 47, you only need to make assertions in your paper. You do not have to provide proof or evidence for your assertions because only secular writers do it that way. As Christians, we don't have to provide proof or evidence for our assertion. This is obviously false. Now, the last thing, of course, is the fill in the blanks of the 14 anathemas in academic writing. Here we go. Commas and periods outside the quotation marks, that's an anathema. Exclamation marks, anathema. Sarcasm, emotional outbursts, wrong pagination or page numbers, wrong margins, misspelled words, extremely long sentences, misuse of commas, use of first and second person personal pronouns, that would be I or you. Number 11, use of cliches. Number 12, improper style in footnotes. 13, assertions without a proper defense. And 14, writing in the passive voice. Well, if you have hung in here from lecture 1 all the way to lecture 5, and if you have been able to complete these quizzes with 90% or better, you learned a lot about grammar and academic style. If you haven't yet been able to finish these quizzes with a 90% or higher, stick with it until you do. You can do it. Just listen to it over, read the notes again, and go back over the material. I thank you for having been with me. It's been a delight. I look forward to administering the final exam to you, which is a comprehensive exam that covers all 5 lectures. God bless.